Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Welcome to the Peter King Podcast. Really happy you could join me this week. Got a couple of really good conversations. Chris Collinsworth, the analyst on Sunday Night Football on NBC, the host of a new podcast, the Chris Collinsworth Podcast, featuring Richard Sherman, will be on. He's also the owner of Pro Football Focus, PFF. And we'll also be joined by Thomas Dimitroff, the former general manager of the Atlanta Falcons. Do a little exit interview with Thomas Dimitroff, who was let go now a week and a half ago by Atlanta owner Arthur Blank. We'll talk about what's in his future. But first, before we get to those, you know, everybody, as you wake up this morning on Wednesday, if you listen to this on Wednesday, whatever day it is, probably the big story of the early part of this week is that the Miami Dolphins, on a two-game win streak, with a veteran wily quarterback in Ryan Fitzpatrick, have decided to change quarterbacks, going to Tua Tagovailoa, the fifth pick in the 2020 NFL draft. You've obviously seen the first pick in the draft, Joe Burrow, have some great moments with the Bengals. Clearly, he's the quarterback of the long-term future in Cincinnati. And you've seen the sixth pick in the draft, Justin Herbert with the Los Angeles Chargers, look as good or better, really, than Burrow in the early season play from him. So I think in a normal year, I would look at the decision by Brian Flores to sit his veteran quarterback and play the kid. I'd look at this in a normal year and I would say, what is this coach doing? You are coming off a destruction of the San Francisco 49ers, the defending NFC champs, who, although being beset by injuries, are still a threat. And to score 43 points on the defending NFC champs in San Francisco and then come back home and throttle the New York Jets 24-0, something about it just doesn't make sense. You know, especially because, hey, Ryan Fitzpatrick's his numbers are good. And so you think to yourself, you know, probably a little bit too soon. But I think we're not living in normal times. And I'll tell you why. First of all, Tua Tagovailoa played not exactly what you would call a classic pro-style offense at Alabama, because he did throw the ball deep. They had a great receiving core, obviously, led by Henry Ruggs. They had a great receiving core. And so he was able to hone his downfield ball skills as well as, you know, his sort of frenetic in the pocket and out of the pocket way of both running and throwing on the run. So he is a really different kind of quarterback. And I'm sure that Brian Flores in Miami looks at him and say, we're not going to force him to be our kind of quarterback. We're going to do what he does best. But anyway, my point is, I think when we look at football today, we look at quarterbacks who come to the NFL so much more ready to play and to play at a high level in the NFL. All you have to do is look at the last four seasons, really. Think about it. Look at how Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes come out of the 2017 draft, and almost right away, they really are talented, and they totally change the game in Kansas City and Houston. And then, you know, obviously we can look at the next year. We can look at Josh Allen in Buffalo, who had a couple of good years, and this year seems to have taken the next step. We'll see how it does for the whole year. But you've got so many young guys. Jared Goff, obviously, playing very well this year, led the Rams to the NFC title a couple of years ago. Anyway, and then last year, Kyler Murray, what he has done, he is a totally fascinating amusement park of a quarterback to watch play football. So, and now you see what has happened with Burrow and Herbert. And I got to tell you, if I'm Chris Greer, the GM in Miami, if I'm Brian Flores, we know what we have in Ryan Fitzpatrick. We know exactly what he is. We are 3-3 right now in our bye week, and we have a tough run of the schedule coming up, coming out of the bye, and we need to basically get better as a team. And I think this is the attempt by the Miami Dolphins to get better and to be on the level of some of the best teams in football coming out of their bye. I didn't think I would say this when I first heard the news, but I like the decision. I think it's gutsy. I think it's a good gamble. And I think Tua Tagovailoa is going to make it pay. And let's just say the worst thing happens. Let's say he's awful through three games. Ryan Fitzpatrick does not have any ego in this. I'm sure he's got a little some, but he doesn't have a lot of ego in this. And I believe that Ryan Fitzpatrick will accept this. And if he has to come in and play the rest of the year at some point, he'll be good with that too. So I think it's a good call. It's a good move by Brian Flores. And quite honestly, I'm really excited about seeing Tua play football. So let's get into our interviews now, our conversations with Chris Collinsworth and Thomas Dimitroff. We're going to start with Collinsworth. I found him at his home studio in Cincinnati, not his home. The office is a Pro Football Focus in the studio there. So let's get to our conversation with Chris Collinsworth. Happy to be joined on the podcast this week by Chris Collinsworth. This is the great Chris Collinsworth's second appearance on the Peter King podcast. The first one, I think we did at the Combine a couple of years ago. But this one, the world has sort of changed a little bit, and it's your job is really kind of different now a little bit because you're more and more involved with Pro Football Focus, it seems to me, and you've got a fun new podcast with Richard Sherman. In fact, when this podcast drops, your latest with Richard Sherman would drop. So tell me how the Richard Sherman portion of your Chris Collinsworth podcast featuring Richard Sherman came to be.
My boys at PFF wanted me to do a podcast, right? Mostly they just want a promo for their own podcast. So I do a lot of that too. So we got a lot of podcasts at PFF. So that's a good thing. And so they said, all right, you know, Chris, we can get you all kinds of guests. And they started naming off coaches and players, and we'll get you Richard Sherman. I was like, whoa. If you get me Richard Sherman, I'll take him every week. He and I will do a podcast together. I'll do one every week. So I just kind of laid down the gauntlet going, they're not getting Richard Sherman to do this thing every week. You know, there's just no way. And somehow they did. I don't know what they did. They probably embezzled some money. I don't know, but we've got Richard and he's fantastic. I mean, he tells some of the best stories. You know, he played high school football in Compton. And so you're talking about, and he told a story today about, I think it was Palos Verdes or something. One of the Pete Carroll's kid played on Palos Verdes. And of course that's a very wealthy, affluent neighborhood. And he said that for the playoffs, they literally do like a coin flip as to, do you play here or do you play there? So you can imagine these Palos Verdes kids coming down.
Don't want to lose the coin flip.
I was like, oh, God, please don't let us lose this coin flip. You know, I was like, did they bring any fans? And he goes, yeah, they actually did have some fans. He said, but our locker room was getting rebuilt. And so when they were coming down and they're getting off their buses that were made of gold, and they come down through the thing, and our locker room's getting rebuilt. So literally our team of like 35 kids is outside. Like we're in the parking lot and beside the field, and we're getting dressed. We get our uniform on as these kids with their, you know, with God only knows what their locker room looked like, you know. They got to walk right by us. And I said, and they're probably all looking at you, and I'm thinking that you're all thinking the same thing, right? And he goes, yeah. We're going to kill these guys. They didn't score 2 years in a row, you know. So, I mean, he just can bring you inside places and help understand. We actually have a social justice podcast that we've done. And I've literally been afraid to play this thing yet. I'm like, I'm going to wait till after the election. It's like, no matter what anybody says right now, it's just political. You know, it's just this. But it's some really great stories of his growing up and my growing up. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, we grew up in the 70s and I went to high school then. My dad was a high school principal. They integrated the schools. There were fights every day in our high school. So it was really an interesting chance for me to get inside his world a little bit. And I think he got inside my world, but it was really fun. It was, I don't want to say entertaining, but insightful way of understanding something that maybe people don't understand that well.
I got to tell you my very quick Richard Sherman story. So you'll get a kick out of it. In 2013, I was asked by Sports Illustrated to do this website called the MMQB. So I said, yeah. And in those days, back when before the bottom really fell out of a lot of media companies, we had a little bit of money at Sports Illustrated. And I said, I want to get an NFL player to do a column for us every week. So they said, oh, that'd be great. And one of the editors said, you think you could get Aaron Rodgers? I said, I don't know, but he wasn't the guy I had in mind really. And one other editor said, oh, you think you're getting Brady, don't you? And I said, no, I said, I wouldn't ask Tom, and not that he would do it, but I want to ask somebody who will say things I don't want to ask somebody to say, hey, we got Aaron Rodgers to do a column. I have no idea whether he would have done it or not. He probably wouldn't have. But we got Aaron Rodgers to do a column. After the initial headline, it's all about Aaron Rodgers saying something. I said, I have an idea. The guy who I'm going to go after is Richard Sherman. And one of the editors had this quizzical look on his face. And I could tell he did not know who Richard Sherman was. Because remember, this was like April of 2013. He was still on his first contract.
Right.
But anyway, I had had some experience with him. And I said, hey, he's fantastic. So I said, I'm going to go have a meeting with him and try to talk him into doing it. So I went to Seattle and I thought I was going to meet him somewhere. I don't know where. And instead, he said, hey, I'm at the Macklemore concert at Key Arena. Why don't you come over? It's this thing that Pete Carroll does for a benefit for kids. And Macklemore is going to sing. So you can just watch the concert with me. And I said, okay. So I went over. We watched him for a little while. And then there was like an intermission. And we walked out into the concourse outside where he was watching the concert. And I explained. And after like 2 minutes, he said, yeah, I'll do it. He didn't even ask what the money was or what anything was. But I framed it to him like this way. I said, you change the narrative, not just of players, but of you. I said, nobody knows who you are. You're going to have the opportunity to form. And I said, and it kind of helps that next year you're going to be a free agent. and you think you're the best corner in football. So let's, you know, let's tell people who Richard Sherman is. And literally after 2 minutes, he said, I'll do it. And I said, you mean I really didn't have to fly 3,000 miles to do this? But he, Chris, he was so incredibly good because he was not afraid to take on any topic.
Yeah, you know,
go ahead.
People don't know that he was the salutatorian in his high school.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a smart guy.
Really smart. Really
but smart. Everybody's introduction to him really came from, you mad, bro?
Yeah.
Right? And he told that story today about the whole Tom Brady, you know, coming over. And he goes, everybody thinks Tom Brady's this humble guy. I mean, there's a great picture of when we were doing this on the field. During the game, they're up 10 points. Earl Thomas had just dropped an interception. But Earl went up to tell him, he goes, hey, I'm going to get you. You're not getting out of here. You're lucky on that one, you know. And so then Tom is literally, he goes, then we're all kids. Like nobody, we don't even know. So we all want to go get in on the conversation with Tom too. So I got this great huddle going around all our defense, going around Tom Brady, and he's like dismissed us. He was like, look at the score. You know, you guys added us on our heads, sent us on our way, and then we come back and win the game. So then afterwards, of course, he said something about come back and see me after the game or whatever, like
right. Look
at the scoreboard, see who's behind, the old high school cheer, you know. So I went back to see him after the game. I go, what's the matter? You mad, bro? You mad?
Yeah.
What's
going on? Yeah. You know, so, that was great. Chris, you remember after the Aaron Andrews sideline thing when he has the emotional confrontation on the field with Michael Crabtree. And sure. It's a classic example of why PR people and why the NFL like the cooling off period after games. You know, they don't really want you to do an interview on the field unless you're a very calm, respectful person within 45 seconds after the game. But Richard Sherman was just, you know, high on emotion at that point. And so anyway, that day after he does that, that was the NFC Championship game. And that night I called him, I texted him and I said, you got to do a column tonight. We never asked him to do one on a game day, but I said, you're the hottest guy in America. You've got to do a column tonight. And I was shocked. He wrote right back. He said, okay, I'll do it. So we did the column that night. We posted the column the next day. It got 5 million page views. Wow. And Barack Obama talked about it. And the reason why it was so smart for Sherman to do this, and I'm sure you would say the same thing about this podcast, because then you get to control the narrative about yourself. Okay. He was able to explain, I am not some huge thug, even though I, you know, went crazy with Aaron Andrews after this game. There's a method to my madness. And you may have thought what he did was thuggish after the game that day and screaming about Crabtree and all that stuff. And maybe he was, but the point is he controlled the narrative. He explained that. So after you read that column, you said, I still think he's a bleep, but at least now I understand where he's coming from. And he's just, I just think he's really one of the smartest players I've ever dealt with.
I agree with you. And he, there's a lot of people that he really gets under their skin. Our buddy, Bob Costas.
Yeah.
Had a real confrontation with him, and Richard challenged some question that he asked and insulted Bob over it. And so, you know, Bob was mad as a hornet. Richard was mad. I don't even think they got two sentences into the interview.
Yeah.
So everything is possible, but it's the same sort of reason that we love watching Charles Barkley or John McEnroe or Terry Bradshaw, is you never know what's going to come out of their mouth. I always said doing that Fox pregame show with Bradshaw was like walking the high wire. Like you had to watch because you were never sure when somebody was going to fall off and die. Right. And there was literally that possibility every single week. And we actually had a code word on that show where it's basically, hey, don't go there, which means if anybody said that to you, you may not understand what you just said, but you need to apologize immediately for what you just said, because so many times, and I don't know how many, if this has happened to you or not, but it has happened to me a ton of times that I had no idea I said something controversial.
Yeah.
The next day when I'm reading my name all over the newspaper or social media or whatever the case may be, because you know, you're on there 3 hours. I mean, 3 hours of live television. The president of the United States barely talks for 3 hours in front of the audience that we have every single week. So it's a dangerous high wire act, but it's fun, right? You're alive. It's just like playing football. Like Richard, you were telling the thing on Richard, and I was thinking in my mind, God, I miss that. I miss that just raw, out of your mind state that you get in when you're playing a football game. And some people can snap right out of it and go back in the locker room and they're normal. But a lot of people can't, you know, and it's like you carry that, especially when you get beat, you carry that with you off that field. And 10 minutes for some people isn't nearly long enough of a period of time to try and cool down.
Chris, one of the things I really wanted to get into today was about sort of the difference in football in the time that we've sort of both been in it. For those who don't know, my first year covering the NFL was 1984. I covered the Cincinnati Bengals for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Chris was a wide receiver for the Bengals. I got to know him a little bit. Then I moved on. He stayed. He's still in Cincinnati. But I, you know, the one interesting thing that I always think of when I think back to those days compared to today, like I just imagine what it was like to go up and prepare to face, let's just take the Pittsburgh Steelers, where, you know, you didn't play them in the 70s when they won their 4 Super Bowls, but this was a really, really formidable team in the course of your career when you played them. Chuck Knoll is coaching them. You're going up against Donnie Shell and a great secondary. And anyway, but I just wonder, today, a wide receiver, who cares, knows everything about Donnie Shell's tendencies. He knows them from watching a ridiculous amount of tape. He knows them from studying the numbers and where a guy is likely to go when you're going to run this play. Whereas before, I really wonder, how much did you know about a team that you were about to play when you entered that game? And maybe compare it now, since you're in the PFF world, compare it to what a player would know today.
I knew more about happy hours after practice than I knew about the guys that I was. I mean, we did. I mean, Turk and I, Turk Schoner, God rest his soul. I love that guy. But we were like the only two single guys in Cincinnati, I feel like, at the time. And so we would always, you know, as soon as practice is over, they would have like, you know, these things where they'd set up a buffet bar or whatever. And if you came in and ordered a drink, you could eat tacos and you could eat those. So we ate dinner like that every single night. But now I'm telling you, I'm going to do a little promo for PFF, but I can go on PFF Ultimate, and I wish this were available to the general public. It's not, it's just available to the teams. And with three clicks of the keys, I can take that guy and go, okay, I only want to watch him, the cornerback I'm playing against, on third down, less than 5 yards, in bump and run coverage in the final 2 minutes of either half. Like, however, it's like Google. It's like, however I want to study that guy, I can do it. So now, if you're not studying your opponent now, it's only because you've chosen not to. I can spend a half an hour in studying somebody right now that it would have taken me the full week if I were studying 4 hours a day of what was going on, because it is just available to you at clicks of the fingers now. So you're absolutely right. Everybody knows so much more about what they're going to see on the other side of the ball. I mean, the guys are literally now putting every inside spin pass rush move that they'll face against one opponent, then every outside rush, and then every bull rush, and then every one-arm stab rush. And you can break it down into segments where you know exactly what that opponent is going to do, and you can do it in less than an hour. I mean, that's really where we are at this point.
How much would you do when you played? How much would you study your opponent?
We would study, because nobody had film at home. You couldn't take film home on your Microsoft Surface. You couldn't do any of that stuff. I mean, it was there weren't computers. I mean, it sounds like I'm talking about caveman days, but you went home. You know, you went out to dinner, you had drinks, you had a party, you had fun. We went to the precinct. We did whatever you did back in those days. But when we were in the film room, that's what they would do. They would put on a tape, and every day we would watch a different game of that defense, right? But generally, we were doing that as an entire team. So I'm getting – it's actually one of my favorite parts of that era was – I learned about special teams because I was in those meetings. I learned about offensive line play from Jim McNally. I learned about quarterback play. I learned about tight end play because we were all getting coached at the same time in the same room by the same film.
Yeah.
So I got much more of a broad-based education about football than maybe what they're getting today because they can be so specific with what they're studying.
So today, as you know, the owner of PFF, the majority owner, I think I'm saying that correct, of PFF, when you look at what has become of the sport of football, are you in any way surprised that it's gotten to this point where everything is so analytically driven, where the Baltimore Ravens have 8 to 10 employees who do only analytics, who use a lot of PFF stuff, and they just try to dive even deeper to get an edge? How do you look at the game now where analytics is such a big part of it?
I actually think it's better. I just think it's more interesting. We're seeing almost all coaches now going for it on fourth down at a rate that we have never seen in the history of the game. And our guys were at the very forefront of that. I mean, Peter, we have guys now submitting papers to MIT that are going on to the finals of the analytics community of what we're studying. I've got full-time mathematicians. I've got math professors that work here because that's what it is now. It's a mathematical formula. And I think one of the things that irritates people so much is when you choose to go for it on fourth down and three, like Mike Zimmer did in the game that we had the other night against Seattle. And it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work. And you go, oh, the analytics is all, that's all crazy. That's just stupid stuff. Well, no, all analytics says is that 50-50 decision that you've always thought about over the years is actually a 51-49 decision. All you gain is 2 points of an advantage. But if you ride that analytical advantage all the way through in the same way that Doug Peterson did with the Philadelphia Eagles, and he was kind of ahead of the curve a little bit back when he was doing it and winning a Super Bowl. But if you think back to that year, all the success that they had on fourth down, I don't know what their success rate was, but it was probably ahead of the curve, and they were playing every mathematical advantage all the way throughout the course of the season, and they had good luck on top of it, and they won a Super Bowl.
That I had no intention of asking you this question, but what did you think of Romeo Crennel going for 2 when he's up 7 late against the Titans? If he kicks the extra point, obviously he's up 8, and with 2 minutes to go, Tennessee would have to drive the length of the field and get a 2-point conversion to tie the game and send it to overtime. If he makes the 2, game's essentially over. They didn't make it. Tennessee went down to score a touchdown, got the ball first in overtime, and scored a touchdown there. So Romeo Crennel got absolutely ripped. So give me your thought on his call.
To me, that's kind of a push. And I'm going to plagiarize this one from Sam Monson, I think, is the one that said it. But really, all you're doing is you're going our two-point conversion versus their two-point conversion. If I make my two-point conversion, we win the game, right? The game's over right at that point. So basically, you're creating a situation where if you have a chance to end the football game with one play and you have control of the ball at that point, the seven-point lead doesn't do anything different for you because at that point, right, you're probably going to kick the field goal. If it's an eight,
well, they're going to kick the extra point.
Kick the extra point.
Yeah. Yeah.
But down in this situation, now you go for two, you make it, game over. If you don't, they're still going to kick the extra point. Very few people go for two at the end of the game when they're doing that.
Right.
The math, and we've been through this argument. Al and I went through this all friggin' day, the day that it happened. The math actually says that's the right play. It's not a big margin. Again,
right,
it might even be 50.5 to 49.5.
But let me, this is the thing about the two-point conversion that has always frustrated me, okay? I forget what number of years it is, but I think the NFL teams over the last 4 or 5 years, whatever number it is, are 52% making the two-point conversion. And so I guess if I had a mobile quarterback and I knew that I had a bunch of good two-point plays, I mean, let's say you're the Tennessee Titans, where, in my opinion, Ryan Tannehill is more mobile than people give him credit for. You have a brilliant offensive coordinator, in my opinion, and Arthur Smith calling the plays. And I'm sure that he's got 10 two-point plays that he's really confident in. You've got a bigger physical receiver like A.J. Brown. You've got a bigger physical tight end, athletic tight end in Jonnu Smith. And you obviously, you've got the greatest big back in recent NFL history in Derrick Henry. Why you score in the first quarter? Why don't you every time go for two?
I think, you know, it's interesting. We saw Mike Tomlin do that a few years ago and didn't hit some
right
early on. Had a couple of games where, you know, they missed the first two and all of a sudden they're behind. It's hard. There's a pressure that builds with that. And the other thing that I've never seen a study on, I was actually going to suggest it to our guys, is there's a difference between going for two in the first quarter pressure-wise and going for two with the line. Not everybody as a receiver, as a quarterback or a running back wants the ball with the game on the line and one play. It's a different monster. Now in the first quarter, okay, let me make a catch and 2-point conversion. And if we miss it, no big deal. They got plenty. The entire game's on the line. That's a different thing. That's the reason that catch by DK Metcalf the other night in our game was so impressive to me. It was a hard catch. He was clearly battling to get in position to have a chance to make that catch, caught it below the waist, overhanded. That was a hell of a play. And it was a hell of a play under the most extreme of pressure. And not everybody in football wants any part of that. Not everybody wants to take that last second shot when you're down one. Everybody wants to take it when you're tied and you got a chance to win it. Not everybody wants to take that shot when you're down one or down two at the end of a basketball game. So, you know, there's mathematical equations and there's human elements to those decisions as well.
You know, the Titans fascinate me. And I'm going to ask you one thing, and then I really am interested when we close. I really want to talk about the stats that you like, that you value. But I want to say something about the Titans. I wrote this week about Ryan Tannehill. And my point was that, you know, it's okay sometimes if you say, I was wrong about this guy. Or if you say, yeah, I really needed to see more of him. And now that I have seen more of him, I think he's one of the best players at his position in football. And you look at the moment when he took over the job, which, by the way, we're taping this Tuesday, October 20. It'll drop tomorrow on Wednesday. It was 1 year ago today that Ryan Tannehill took over the starting quarterback job from Marcus Mariota in Tennessee. He's 12-3 since, plus two more playoff wins. And if you look at, since he took this job over, he's got the highest rating of any quarterback in football, which, you know, passer rating is eh. But yards per attempt, which I really value because I think it says a few things, you know, he's 7/10 of a yard better than any other quarterback in football over the last year. So I wonder, first of all, I just want to get your thoughts on the Titans on offense in general, and then specifically about Tannehill.
Yeah, I think he's playing great. Obviously, you know that. George and I were just talking about this a little bit, that as a receiver, your goal was to always see either cover one, man-to-man coverage, cover zero, which is man-to-man coverage without a safety, which is even better, or cover three. Because everything else is hard, right? They're muddled. It's two safeties. Is the corner really playing cover four and dropping back, or is he playing cover six on this side? Which is exactly how Aaron Rodgers threw that pick six the other day, by the way.
Yeah.
Because it looked like a cover four and that corner was going to drop back, but in reality, he was playing the flat and Aaron just didn't see it and he got picked off. That's what happened with that one. So it is, when you have a running back like Derrick Henry, you have no choice in the matter. You have to play cover one or cover three, maybe quarters, get the guy to come down and help a little bit, but you have to find a way to stop that monster from running the football. And so now he's done a couple of things. A, he's put you in the coverage that I prefer to play against. You know, I mean, that's the coverage that I definitely would prefer to see. And everything on the field looks so clean to the quarterback. I mean, it's just so much easier to know what they're going to do. Now you can run your pick plays. You can run those crossing routes. You can do, you know, it's not like some teams now are so sophisticated. You never get the same look pre-snap and post-snap. You just never get it from these top-end defensive coordinators. But with Derrick Henry in the game, that strong safety is not sitting about 4 yards off the line of scrimmage. We're going to run it right down your throat. You know, hey, back there in cover two, Derrick Henry's going to run right there. Right there, we're going to run Derrick Henry. And we're going to run him all day until your butt comes up here, right? And so, I mean, that's part of what I think has made Tannehill, you know, they've got good receivers too. You know,
you
have A.J. Brown's a real player. I love watching him play. And Corey Davis has had a moment or two this year already. So this is a team that, as long as they have the force that is Derrick Henry and the simplicity of the coverages that they're going to see on the backside, I think Tannehill is going to continue to play well.
Were you watching the game live when Derrick Henry lined up as the Wildcat quarterback, you know, in overtime?
Is that the one with the stiff arm?
No. When they're playing Houston, it's 3rd and 5 at the 5-yard line, and Derrick Henry lines up as the quarterback.
Oh, no, I wasn't watching it.
Okay, so Derrick Henry takes the snap, and he burrows into the end zone, and he scores. And he ran it on that play sort of like Le'Veon Bell. It was kind of a thoughtful run. Hey, let me wait until I see something that I really like, and then I'm going to attack it. But I really loving watching Derrick Henry run because he had the 94-yard run the other day. It's that I think, like Le'Veon Bell, he puts a lot of thought into what he does. He isn't just an anvil in shoulder pads. You know, he's a guy who thinks about where he's going and why he's going. And he doesn't have an ego about it, really. He knows that if he runs it 25 times a game, 8 or 10 times, he's going to get 1 or 2 yards. That's just that's the cost of doing business, you know.
I think he's lucky as hell that Mike Vrabel is his coach too.
Yeah.
Vrabel is one of those natural tough guys, right?
Yeah.
When we go to practice, like I see other coaches try to do things where they'll jam the receiver or they'll, you know, they'll get out and, you know, kind of get involved just to be one of the guys and do all that stuff. Vrabel goes out there and he is in hand fighting wars with these big 6'6" offensive linemen and pass rushers. I mean, he's doing battle. This is a true, true tough guy. And when I watched Derrick Henry, I went to the national championship game and he had a huge game that game as well. But I remember coming out of there going, yeah, he's good, but he's kind of a dancer. And, you know, it's not just this, you know, he doesn't take advantage of all 250 pounds. And so now I think to your point, we're seeing what he has from a natural capability of the moves, the dancing, the thoughtfulness, all that kind of stuff. And he has somewhere in the back of his brain, Mike Vrabel going, I am going to kill you if you don't put your head down and run over and guys, right? And somewhere in between there, they've created a monster that is just terrorizing the league right now.
Chris, if you had to choose, if you're a general manager of a moribund team and your owner says to you at the end of this year, well, I want you to survey the field right now and I want you to pick the coach that's going to turn us around. Who's the assistant coach in the NFL or college quarterback right now who you would go hard after because you really believe in him?
Eric Bieniemy. I would have done it last year. Everybody, you know, all these owners and GMs, they call you. They want, because we meet everybody. We meet them. Eric Bieniemy, he's a dynamic personality. Obviously he's been in the room with Andy Reid with the most creative of offenses. He's the offensive coordinator. Is he the play caller? No, but it's about play design. It's about play creation. It's about knowing the type of athlete you need to put together those kind of creative offenses, right? And he's a great guy.
What's the hang up? He should have gotten a job 2 years ago. Why are we still talking about this?
I'm gonna give the league the benefit of the doubt. I'm sure there are going to be other people that say that the Rooney Rule is not effective enough, and that's the reason that he didn't get a job. I can't explain it because in my mind, I knew him. I'd had a ton of conversations with him. I knew the character. He's like Vrabel. He's kind of one of those in your face kind of guys and leaders. So I was stung, and I told Al before our opening broadcast in Kansas City, I was like, I'm going to go get these guys on this issue a little bit. I'm going to go after him a little bit. Cause that is wrong that guy didn't get a job. But anyway, and then, Trevor Lawrence. I watched that kid play the other day. And if you're going to give me one swing, we were talking about it with Richard Sherman on the podcast as well. And he was saying, you know, you got Sam Darnold, you already spent a top five pick. You could trade away that pick and you could get set up your franchise for the rest of your life. I'm like, no way. In New York City, if they pass up the number one pick, no matter which team it is that may have it, and they don't draft Trevor Lawrence for the next 6 months, there is only one headline on the back pages of every one of those newspapers that you blew it. And that was the chance of a lifetime and you didn't take it.
So now, if you're Joe Douglas now, if you're the Jets, and the first thing you got to do is pick the coach. All right. So if you've got to pick the coach, I take it you're Bieniemy's number one on your list.
Yes, sir. And I'm recreating Kansas City everything. I want Trevor Lawrence is the same kind of player that Patrick Mahomes is. He can move. He's creative. He's going to move around. He's been good for a long, consistent period of time. And then I'm going out and I'm finding all the Kelseys and the, you know, Lairs. And I'm just redoing it. Yeah.
So that's really interesting. I've thought about this a lot. And again, look, I absolutely unequivocally do not think that this is Sam Darnold's fault at all. But I also think exactly what you think. If you have a chance to get a guy who appears to be, you know, who knows? Maybe he's the best quarterback to come out since Andrew Luck. Maybe he's the best since before then. And it's very, very hard to pass on that. But let's just say you go ahead and do it. And let's say that you get, I don't know, pick a number. You get a high two for Sam Darnold, or maybe a two and a four. Then I think what you are at that point, because obviously you've got so many picks coming into next year. You know, you've got Seattle's pick in the first round. You've got Seattle's pick in the third round. So even if you have to, let's say, start over at quarterback, and if you have an extra one, two, and three, I mean, how in the world do you not do that? And so I probably would side with you in rebuilding the Jets in Kansas City mode.
I mean, Joe Burrow, I can only speak for living in Cincinnati. Joe Burrow has put the hope back in Cincinnati fans. Put the hope back in it. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that they've got some tickets to sell, right?
Right.
In both stadiums. And is that lovely Ann behind you?
Yeah, it is. Hello. Ann, say hi to Chris.
How are you?
Hi, Chris. Come on down. There she is.
Not for me. That woman. Yeah.
Right, and there's Chuck the dog. Yeah.
The greatest cookies in the history of God's green earth. I love it. Greatest.
Yeah.
Anytime you want me to do a podcast, Ann, you just call me. I'm on.
Yeah, you just you're like Costas. You'll do anything if you get the cookies.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, the thing you said about Cincinnati to me is so interesting, because I love Joe Burrow, and now it's so interesting. Justin Herbert, how do you not love what you see of him? Of and you know, the way that Miami obviously has just announced that Tua Tagovailoa is going to be the starter. Normally, you might say, you've won the last two games by 26 and 24 points. You know, your quarterback is having a good year, not a transcendent year, and you make a change. But I think this is all about, you know, you're not afraid to make changes with young quarterbacks anymore, I think, the way you used to be.
Well, they're just so valuable. I mean, the gap right now between what you have to pay a rookie quarterback, even a highly drafted one, and what you're having to pay the top end players at $35 million plus, 35 to 5 million or whatever they're paying those young quarterbacks is a lot of money. That's a lot of linebackers and guards and safeties and cornerbacks that can really make a difference on your team. So is the gap between a great veteran and Aaron Rodgers, the Patrick Mahomes, whatever, so great that I can make up the $40 million difference that Mahomes is going to get, you know, and what I'm going to get with a guy for 4 years on a rookie contract, quarterback, you know, that's a big hurdle to jump over.
Can I ask you one last thing? What's the one statistic that is commonly readily available, or that you guys do at PFF that you believe is most telling and most valuable when it comes down to judging the quarterback position?
I like time to throw. I think that is, I personally don't believe offensive lines have a whole lot to do with protection. And that's going to sound like the dumbest thing out of a lifetime of dumb things that I've ever said. But I think it's really about the quarterback position. If Peyton Manning and Eli Manning were not going to get hit, I don't care what you did to them. And eventually they broke the spirit of those defensive coaches. They wouldn't even try and blitz them. It's like, you might as well just go ahead and drop back and play coverage. And yet you've got these young quarterbacks who are just the opposite of that. I mean, Josh Allen, if I could just get him to get the ball out of his hand occasionally, like I would tell, if I coached Josh Allen, I would say, the first five plays, we're playing like Jimmy Garoppolo here for a little while. We're going to get this. We're going to catch it, and we're going to throw it. We're going to convince somebody that you're not going to hold the ball for 3 seconds. Because when you hold the ball for more than 2.5 seconds, 2.5 seconds is the cutoff. If you hold it longer than 2.5 seconds, you're telling the defensive coordinator, you might as well yell over to the sideline and go, hey, blitz me. I'm too stupid. Go ahead and blitz me all you want. Where in reality, you've got a guy like Josh Allen who's playing so great, you know, until the last couple of games here, that, you know, you want that guy, if he learns how to play efficiently, if he learns how to manipulate what the pass rush can do to him and can do all these things with his arm, with his legs, throw it 80 yards down the field, if he can do all that stuff and manipulate and control that pass rush and how often they can come after him, now you've got, now you're into the Elways and the great players and what they can do. But you've got to convince yourself college football is different. I had a kid that I coached the local high school team, and I said, and he was getting ready to sign at Kentucky, a quarterback. And I said, all right, we're going to start doing a drill. All right. I want you to catch the ball. So I'd, you know, shotgun snap the ball to him, and I'd go 1,001, 1,002 sack. Right. I go, you stand back here in high school and you hold it for 8 seconds because we have a great team and you dance around and you look good and all that kind of stuff. You're going to go down there and you're going to play Alabama and they're going to hit you before you get finished fiddling with the ball. You catch it and you kind of flip it around in your hands a little bit. I said, they're going to hit you in the ear hole before you find the laces on that football. I said, so we've got to do some drills now. Catch it, throw it, catch it, throw it, get it out. Now, all of a sudden, now you've got them down to a three-man rush because you broke their spirit. Now you want to move around. Absolutely. Let's buy some time. Let's break down the zone defenses. Let's figure out a way to do that. But it's a the guys who know how to do that are so much fun to watch. It feels like they're toying with the team. I mean, Aaron Rodgers in that game the other day, the only reason they got beat is because they started blitzing and the Packers could not come up with an answer. So they literally every play. So usually Aaron is manipulating the defense in that way. For whatever reason, the Bucs just had an answer for everything Green Bay wanted to do.
Chris Collinsworth, I've kept you long enough. The analyst of Sunday Night Football on NBC, host of the Chris Collinsworth podcast featuring Richard Sherman, owner of PFF. It's Tuesday afternoon. I'd really like to see you take the rest of the day off. You've had enough to do.
Not a prayer. I got so much work to do today. It is unbelievable. But for you, for Ann, anything.
Chris, thanks a lot. Have a great day. Have a great week.
Thanks, Peter.
It's officially grilling season at the Home Depot. So don't miss Memorial Day savings on grills happening now, so you can celebrate with a backyard barbecue for the whole block. Step up your grill game and serve up a feast with the Next Grill 4-Burner Gas Grill, with durability to last summer after summer. On special buy, only $199. Get ready for a whole summer of entertaining at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease and a whole lot of love, you transform 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. LED headlights, spoilers, whatever you need. eBay Motors has it at affordable prices. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride every time. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the greatest, but let me play devil's advocate here. Let's see. So, no, that's a good thing. that's definitely not a problem. Reese's, you did it. You stumped this charming devil.
Happy to be joined on the podcast this week by Thomas Dimitroff, the former general manager of the Atlanta Falcons. Sort of pains me to say that, Thomas. Does it sound weird when I introduce you as the former general manager of the Atlanta Falcons?
It's a little surreal. I've had a week to ruminate on it, of course. I'm just finishing up in Boulder, Colorado for a few days. I needed the mountains, and believe it or not, I was timed it symbolically to be on a mountain trail at exactly the time that the Falcons kicked off with Minnesota. And as fate would have it, very quickly, we ran into a group of people who were raving about Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley. And then they recognized that I was walking by there. It was just a surreal moment. I thought I was escaping it for a while.
Wait a minute. You mean they didn't know who you were? They were just talking about Julio Jones and Calvin Ridley?
They were coming up one side of the trail. We were coming down, and they turned the corner to the next, you know, cross. And they looked down, and I happened to look up at them, and it was just an interesting exchange.
Wow.
And they were ready to get selfies and everything. I thought that's not exactly the selfies that I want to take with the NFL fan base, but it was a good conversation.
Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to ask you about a number of things. And first of all, you know, I do want people to know that in your business, the business of personnel in the National Football League, it's pretty rare to last 12 and a half years in a job. And not only rare, I think there's only two or three GMs in the NFL who have been doing it that long, obviously, or longer. This is a very, very broad, broad question. What's the key to survival at that job?
I think number one, it's obviously having a very good relationship with your owner. That's key. I think alongside of that is an incredibly important relationship, communicative, respectful relationship with your head coach, who is your partner in the team building element of it. I took a lot of pride in my relationship with Mike Smith. We had a great relationship all the way through until, you know, of course, 2015. And then when Dan came on, I take pride in whether anyone else thinks this or not. I think with Dan, like, we had one of the best relationships in sport with a GM head coach relationship. To me, that is very, very important. I think it comes with the communication with both of us as co-team builders, and it is massively important. If you don't have that, I've seen some amazing football people last, a fraction of the time because they just could not get it right with the relationship with their head coach.
Thomas, not to get morbid or anything, but I want to know, take me into the moment that you were fired, which is now 9 days ago. What exactly is that like? And were you expecting it?
Well, I would have to be honest and say I wasn't necessarily expecting the timing. That said, this is a win-driven league, as any sport league is. And I know it more than ever, having been around now 27 years in the NFL and 12 and a half here in Atlanta, that is something that is, it's odd to be in that spot. And I start thinking about it, and I start thinking about when that moment happens. And I've been around football all my life. My father was a longtime coach collegiately in the CFL, as well as a personnel man. I was born and raised to understand that, you know, they don't necessarily hire you to retire you, is the line that Smitty used to use. I will footnote him on that. And I understand that. I understand it's complicated. There are so many levels to it. It's not easy. It's not just, it is wins, but beyond that, there are so many levels that you could discuss probably beyond the scope of this, you know, this podcast. That said, surreal, uneasy, unexpected, all those things. And then you start thinking about all the amazing relationships you have within the organization that you've worked with, you know, for as long as I had. And I think about them, and I think about what's going on with them into the future as well. And so that week, a lot of reaching out to a lot of different people. I happened to be sitting down literally on my sofa in the morning, returning hundreds of texts, of course, trying to be as diligent as I could. And I was literally looking up on Good Morning Football and you know, you're watching what they say. I was watching my firing, so to speak. That's a little odd. They say, and some of our good friends in the media, i.e. Jay Glazer, used to always tell me, make sure that you watch your funeral. Now, that is more, but I don't want to consider this a funeral, but to see how it all plays out. That's not my plan necessarily, but it was an interesting time. I'm regrouping, and I'm in a solid space right now, Peter.
When the words come to you from Arthur Blank, do you remember what your first thought was?
Yeah, my first thought was, I understand that, you know, ultimately this is about wins. I understand that this, you know, Dan and I, as head coach and GM, were ultimately loyal to our owner, and that's what you need to be in this league. You and I both know that. I also understand, respectfully and appropriately, Arthur's ultimate loyalty is to the fan base. There is no question about that. And again, I knew as he was delivering the message to us, we were losing the fan base, and Arthur needed to make a move.
Was there any part of you that was that felt either uneasy, unhappy about Falcons 40, Vikings 23 on Sunday afternoon?
No, I've told my mom, I've told my fiance, and I've told anyone else that loves me in my life, all we want is for the Falcons to continue to win as many games as possible. And it wasn't at all. It was a situation that I know this is a very good football team. For some reason, it was like a symphony with a lot of talented musicians / players within that organization. We weren't in sync for some reason. I'm looking forward to watching how it plays out. Dan and Raheem are very good friends. I know that Dan is happy for Raheem. Not to speak for Dan, happy for him. I'm happy for the way the organization is going to continue. So I was not disappointed. I was not upset. More focused on my height, quite honestly, until I got back and sat down and had a number of texts reminding me of what was happening in Atlanta.
What are you going to do with your life?
It's a great question. Right now, I don't know. It's only a weekend. I have a lot of thoughts. Thankfully to Arthur, I mean, I'm in a good situation right now with some time left. And that's an important thing for me, of course, making sure that I do have, the financial wherewithal to step back a little bit and not have to jump into anything right away. That said, I'm a competitive person and I have a lot of ideas about potentially what I want to do. Not sure exactly where it's going to be, Peter. I think that'll become clearer as I continue to navigate through the next few weeks.
Do you believe that at some point in your future, you'll be a general manager again, or has the thought occurred to you, maybe I want to try something completely different?
Look, I have waves all over the place with that. I mean, I'm again, spending a little bit of time out here in Boulder, Colorado, and you're very aware of my cycling fondness and you know, hiking out here, et cetera, to be out in nature is really, really important for me to delve into my sort of mind, body, and soul element. I don't know yet. I mean, I've thought about it. There are many times I think about what would I do different in all of this? Obviously, I'm not on the field, but what would I have done, you know, as a partner of Dan's? What would we have done together and how would we have adjusted it? Dan and I, again, have a great relationship, and I want to continue to delve into that with both of us and be very honest and candid, because I think that is what's incredibly important for both of us into our future. My personal feeling is I think Dan is a very talented coach. He's a big time motivator and he should be back in the league as a head coach. That's of course up to him. Again, I can't comment on that, but he's done some great things. He did some great things, of course, in Atlanta. And I'm impressed with how it is. And I hope that we can continue to talk and grow with each other and see what we would adjust moving forward.
Two questions about the Falcons in your tenure. The first is, there are those who would look at your team of recent vintage and say, well, they're four games under 500 since they lost the 28-3 lead to New England and lost the Super Bowl, and they never got over that. What do you believe about that?
I believe Dan and this organization came into 17, played beyond to get deep into the playoffs. Unfortunately, that didn't progress into getting us back into the Super Bowl to give us an opportunity. After 17, I feel like we were working really hard to build the right team, get the right players in. And again, back to that symphony analogy, it just felt like one group was playing well and another wasn't for some reason. And why we were hitting and missing on that is complicated for me. And that goes back to wanting to sit down with Dan and talk about all the nuances of building a team, from not only building a team, you know, on the draft board and acquisitions, et cetera, but building the team, the morale, you know, what Dan affectionately called the brotherhood and where brotherhood went during those years after. Did it settle? Was it watered down for some reason? I'm not quite sure. I know Dan beyond put his heart and soul into it. And I know the players believe that and the organization believe that. I believe that I was an important part of that along with Dan. And where it went awry, it's still perplexing at times.
I want to ask you one question about a move that you made that I think is a really interesting move from the standpoint of a decision a general manager has to make. And you make decisions sometimes and don't really know at the moment whether it is the right decision, but you feel so strongly about it. And that is the draft trade up for Julio Jones, you know, almost a decade ago. And that draft trade up where you traded from the low 20s up to number six in the first round to enable you to trade for or to pick Julio Jones. You asked people who you trusted, people who you know in this business, including Bill Belichick, what do you think of this? And I've always heard that Belichick told you, don't do it. A, did he tell you don't do it? B, why did you do it?
Well, A, I mean, Bill and I had some really good conversations about a lot of things that I respect, you know, beyond. And it's been recorded in Michael Holley's book, so I won't continue to talk about that. That said, why did I do it? I mean, the reality was I realized along the way that, interestingly enough, when we were playing in those early years in 8, 9, and 10, we were on our heels many times with those really high impactful receivers or offensive targets. And that was big for me. And I wanted nothing more than for us as an organization with Matt Ryan, having taken the lead by guys like Bill Belichick and guys like Bill Polian, who made sure that they had the right people around their stud quarterback. That was really important for us to get a guy that was going to have people on their heels, whether he was catching four balls or 14 balls. People were really worried about playing the Atlanta Falcons offense. That was massively important to me. And so it was a big deal. And I knew at that time, and you and I have talked about it, I knew that that was going to be a definition of how I was defined moving forward. And if it did go awry, there's no way I would still be in this league at that time. That's how precarious that was and how fine line that move was. And I knew it. And it's funny how in your first few years, still fairly wet behind the ears, you know, you're a little less cautious. And I think I have come a long way in how I would approach things. Would I do it today? Yes. It was a once in an organization's lifetime, at least in my mind, to do something that monumental. It was big, and I knew that there was going to be two sides, Peter. The side that thought, wow, maybe this guy knows what he's doing, and the other side who thought, you know, who thought I was lost in wherever I was lost.
So. But if a guy, but obviously, and you don't want to get into this yourself, I understand. But if a Bill Belichick, who at the time was maybe not seen as exalted a football guy as he is today, but still probably the most knowledgeable personnel slash coach that there was, saying, I don't know about that. I might steer clear of that. What is it inside you that said, you know, I got to do what I think is best for this team?
Bill always taught us along the way that you will know your organization better than anyone, categorically. And there I was in the middle of that conversation. Huge respect for Bill and how he is at so many levels. And it was a crossroad times for me, Peter, because at that time, still again, quite young in the business, I thought I'm going to be listening to who is one of my, you know, mentors in this league with the unbelievable regard people have for Bill and his knowledge. And the crossroad was, wow, I'm now making this decision on my own. So I'm ready to continue to take, you know, this job on head on without looking to the side and looking for advice. I love advice, believe me. But at that point, I knew that life was changing for me as a general manager.
The last thing I would ask you is if a friend of yours in the league who has not been a general manager, let's say, or a friend of yours from elsewhere in football called and said, you know, I'm thinking of getting into this. I really think that I have the knowledge to be a general manager. I really think I can do this, but I want your advice. What is being a general manager for 12 and a half years in the NFL taught you both about football and about this job?
Well, one of the things I'd say is the imperative side of lucid, unbelievably clear communication is so important. I realize it at every juncture while I was in this. If you're not a clear communicator and you're not willing to look people in the eyes and be honest with them, communicate candidly at so many levels, do it in the right way. I always say semantically, responsibly deliver those tough communicative messages. To me, that is vital. You have to be that. Also, I believe the understanding that you're going to be learning every day and you have to be open-minded to learn every day. You're going to get kicked in the stomach left, right, and center in this job. And you're going to have an incessant tug on your time, which is not easy for a lot of people. I know a lot of people that got into this job who just realized 1, 2, and 3 years in, this is not for them because of all of the time that was put into it and how it was pulling away from their being not only, you know, a person, but their family, et cetera, et cetera. You have to seriously commit to it and understand that, you know, while you're in this, the commitment is massively important and you have to be on. You have to be on always. That's complicated. I would, in the end, say making sure that you surround yourself with the right people. I'm a big believer in positive, passionate, and persevering people. I think if you don't have those people around you, you have no shot to last much more than a year or two as a general manager. And then lastly, I mean, I really, really do believe in, you know, I'll throw out this, but, you know, that idea of really soaring for things and going for it, you can't sit on your hands in this league, Peter. There's no way, not for long. I don't care who you are. You can't just conservatively navigate through and put a piece here and there together. 100% believe in going for it. I know that's the X game, you know, line, go big or go home. But, brother, I believe that that's the truth. You have to be smart about how you go after things.
Thomas Dimitroff, a long life in football, an interesting life in football. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Peter.
My thanks to Chris Collinsworth, Thomas Dimitroff for their time. I thought there was some really enlightening stuff on this podcast. Not only Dimitroff talking about what it really feels like to be fired, but I think Collinsworth really delving into some of the ways that analytics are changing football and changing it for the better. Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. Really looking forward to an interesting week of games. I cannot wait to see Pittsburgh at Tennessee. Hope you enjoy your week of football. Have a great week, everybody, and we'll be back next week on the Peter King Podcast.
Summer projects your way with Memorial Day savings from the Home Depot. With free delivery on over 2 million items, you can make the most of summer grilling and dig into gardening. Plus, get same day delivery on thousands of products like power tools and storage to tackle any last minute garage project. Summer your way with Memorial Day savings from the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select and stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.